now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Patty Barkley, Stuart Robson, and broadcasting live from Barnes in beautiful West London, it's Matt Dickinson. Today we'll be focusing on Manchester as we look at City's triumph in the FA Cup and United's title-securing draw at Blackburn. Also, we're privileged to be joined by Dave Boyle from Supporters Direct. He'll be discussing the Select Committee on Football and the influence of fans on the game. So please join us for 40 minutes or so of the best football conversation you're likely to hear all week. Well, let's start at Wembley, where Manchester City have won their first trophy in many of their fans' lifetimes. Off the top of my head, I think this is what Sheikh Mansour is hoping for. Paddy, is this the start of a new era?
Certainly should be. I mean, we spoke a lot in advance about how a trophy would fill the whole club with confidence. That will happen. But for it to come on top of qualification for the Champions League was also very, very important. I don't think Manchester United clinching the title could quite take away the reality, the far from grim reality of those twin towers. I think it should only get better for Manchester City from now. There are doubts about whether Mancini's the man to purchase the players that will be needed to take them on to the very, very top level.
Why are there doubts about him? Shouldn't there be doubts about Brian Marwood, since he's the guy who does it?
I think there are doubts. There are doubts about the relationship. Probably to be more precise, I think the club needs to be marching together. Really, the those who do the recruiting. This is why the future of Liverpool rests on the relationship between Comolli and Dalglish, not Dalglish. That's for those who believe that managers walk on water. It doesn't work like that in reality. The club must all sing from the same hymn sheet, and I think that, you know, there is a doubt that Marwood and Mancini would have the same attitude to recruitment.
I mean, so how do they do the recruitment then? In your view, how do they do the recruitment?
Well, how do they do it now? By just going absolutely picking the top.
But who dictates who? Yes, Marwood does all the deals and he has to go and look at the players, but do you think Manchester, we need a central midfield player that can do this, and then Marwood has to marry up with a midfield player around the world that you can find who can do that job? Or does Marwood say, this is the player you got, now you've got to put him into your team?
I think you must do it both ways, because in the situation Manchester City are in at the moment, it's much more a case of identifying players who can take the club on. And if by signing, let's say, if they get an inkling that Cesc Fabregas is buyable, and I think he probably is, then you might have to jettison players who you would otherwise keep. I'll pick a bad example here, but say you thought Yaya Toure was our best player in the two Wembley games, over the two Wembley games against Manchester United and Stoke City that yielded the cup, but can he play with Cesc Fabregas? Then you might have to sell him. So I think that where City are now, you go for Maradona, you go for Pelé, you go for the best players, and you work around that, because they haven't got time. As we move into the era of financial fair play, unless they build a new stadium in 3 years, they haven't got time to mess around. They have to get Fabregas. They have to get the very top players in the world this summer. And that's it. And if that means, unfortunately, losing some of the ones that you'd hitherto hoped to make progress through, and you know, the winger, the left winger who plays
Adam Johnson.
If that means getting rid of Adam Johnson, fine. He's got resale value.
But I think what Mancini's saying at the moment is that to compete in the Champions League, if they qualify, and to compete for the Premier League title, they have to have a massive squad. That's what he's saying, of 25 of the top players, so they can rotate. He said after the game, rotate 6 or 7 players each week. That's what he said.
That's exactly
after the game.
That's exactly what's needed, and I think that probably, if that's to be achieved, they need to get rid of 8 to 10 players this summer, and bring in 10 to 12. And I mean that's it needn't cost as much money as people imply, because one of the ones who should go is Tevez, because I think they can get a decent fee for him and bring in something better.
Well, actually, I want to turn to the game about Yaya Toure, because at the I think a lot of public opinion was so wrong about this guy.
Yes.
When he arrived, a holding midfielder. Ooh, he's getting, you know, he's. I don't even know if this 220 grand a week figure is accurate. I haven't been able to stand it up. So many people I trust have reported it, so I'm assuming it is. But I think it's fair to say this season we've seen a phenomenal player with a very unusual skill set that may be sometimes difficult to integrate into the side, but certainly, you know, at times carried City in the same way that perhaps Tevez or Vincent Kompany have. Stuart?
Well, the good thing about Yaya Toure is he can play any position in central midfield. And when people criticise him, everyone kept on saying, Manchester, he's playing 3 holding midfield players. Yaya Toure, in some games that I saw, was the second striker and sometimes played as a centre forward.
That's right.
And he is now, and I think I described it a few weeks ago when writing for the Arsenal program, I think it was, he is the best runner with the ball now in English football.
Absolutely.
Taking up the ball and running at the heart of the back four.
He takes the ball from your penalty if you need it. He'll take the ball from your penalty area to the opposition's.
Yeah.
And if that's not a good definition of what football's all about, I don't know what
it is. Dicko.
I agree with that. And I think, you know, as you say, people misinterpreted, certainly, I mean, it's easy to misinterpret why he'd been signed, because we'd seen him play in a certain role for Barcelona. And credit to Mancini for shaping him into something different, into something he needed. And as you say, I mean, you know, it's a heck of a sight seeing a player of his build. I mean, it's almost, I wouldn't say with the grace of Kaká, but, in you know, Kaká is extraordinary how he can cover sort of 60 yards with a ball at his feet.
Yeah,
and Toure,
absolutely,
at times, is insane. But all I would say, and this is quibbling, it's not, you know, before I get bombarded with tweets from mad City fans, is that, you know, in that role, there is nothing better than seeing a Dennis Bergkamp, you know, a classic number 10 with the wiles and the guile and the skills, and say, ultimately, Mancini's got to do what works for them, but you can also see how that has shaped a certain type of City team, which is regarded as lacking in a little bit of finesse. And I'd say this is quibbling and
finesse comes from David Silva, surely, you know, playing from the wide area. I know what he does. He comes inside, and it can come from Tevez. But actually, on Saturday, when Yaya Toure scored his goal, he was actually playing in a holding midfield role, because they just made the substitution. Tevez, Balotelli went to centre forward, Tevez went in behind, and Yaya Toure went for a little while, he went to centre half, and the centre half kept on coming out with the ball, he went to centre half, and it just shows he's an all-round player.
Yeah, don't forget, this is a lad who's played centre half in a Champions League final and won it.
Let's talk about Stoke. Some wonderful storylines there, of course. Peter Coates seeing his team in the FA Cup final at Wembley, you know, sort of X amount of years after he was jeered when he took over the club again. Tony Pulis coming out there in a suit and then changing back into his shell suit and his little hat or whatever it is he wears. I've been critical of Pulis in particular and Stoke, but I think on balance they got to the final, they had a game plan, they've become certainly a much more multidimensional team. I thought, you know, playing somebody like Mark Wilson at left back, who is not just a one-dimensional player, but, you know, who can pass a little bit. I thought they went out there, they gave their best shot, and maybe we should be giving them some credit as well, Stuart, or No.
I saw them play against Arsenal the week before. I know it was Arsenal, not their best. I thought, yeah, they're improving. They're showing a bit more quality. They had a great game plan against Arsenal. But I think Pulis made a mistake by playing Edrington. They were too wide. They got outnumbered in midfield. And that's why Man City ran the game in the first half. And, you know, when they had in midfield Whelan and Delap up against Manchester City three, they were never going to cope with that. And David Silva. And I couldn't believe that he stayed with these wide players, because the wide players didn't affect them. Pennant got a couple of crosses in early on in the game, but he didn't really affect
him. Edrington didn't trust his hamstring, so he was playing basically as Delap would have done had he been in that role. He wasn't.
And
that's what
they changed to in the end.
And
that's how I thought they would start the game, because he had to. That was where I thought Tony Pulis didn't do the job right. He didn't see that Man City were running the game in midfield, and how was he going to change that? Mm. You know, he could have brought Walters back, but Walters got caught halfway in between. I think Walters is a decent player, but in between
it was devastating in the semi, he was excellent,
but he couldn't control the game, and Man City, I thought, were by far and away the better team.
Yes,
perhaps a bit hard though, I think, when you blame a manager for not sticking to the guys who got you there.
But you have to be ruthless. If you've got a player in your side that obviously wasn't fit, you're going to lose a game. You can't play football now with a guy that's only 50% fit.
Mm. I think maybe he was looking how many scorers have I got on the field. Edrington might just nick a goal.
And to be fair, though, I think City, one team that do match up well physically as well.
Mm, with, of course. Long throw-ins weren't a problem, were they?
No, not a problem.
One final thing. Obviously, a lot of controversy said about the fact that, you know, the FA Cup final, you know, being played on a Saturday with Messi Premier League appetizers. We know why it happened. It's because they had to relinquish Wembley X amount of days before the FA Cup final. Yeah. I have one question. This is just a genuine question. Maybe there's a good reason. Why couldn't they have played the full Premier League schedule on Sunday and sort of kept Saturday for the FA Cup?
I think there must be some someone did try and explain it to me, but some broadcasting site, it's part of the global. I mean, obviously, you know, we're not just sticking on these games for all of us here. We have our debts now to Asia and around the world, and I think it's just sort of basically wrapped up in a TV contract. Now, I still don't think that excuses why the title decider was allowed to be on the same day. They should, Man United and Chelsea, if they had been been relevant, should have been on the Sunday. But again, the trouble is, part of that broadcasting contract is presumably that one of the big clubs will be playing on a Saturday. It's, you know, whatever the excuse is, it's not good enough, but it's wrapped up as ever in money and TV.
Let's move on to the what turned out to be the title decider. Not a big surprise that United won the title at Blackburn. Huge game for Rovers, of course. Should we be giving them credit, or should we be blaming Thomas Kuszak on that first goal? Stuart?
Well, Thomas Kuszak had a shocker from the moment he came out to the moment he went back in. He did everything wrong. He took too much time on kicks. He didn't come for crosses. He let balls run across his box. He looked a bag of nerves. And if you don't play regularly, this is the problem with bringing in goalkeepers, and they're the number two for so long, and the other goalkeeper plays every game. When they do come in, you haven't got game experience. Every game is like, I use the term, a cup final tier, and you're under pressure. And he showed that he was under massive pressure. He's probably got that game to prove whether he's good enough to be Manchester United's goalkeeper next year. And one thing he did prove, he's not good enough to be Manchester United's goalkeeper next year.
Makes Steve Harper quite a character, because he must have played, must have waited 10 years for his chance.
Because a lot of goalkeepers are happy being number twos.
Do you remember Liverpool used to unveil the supposedly the greatest number two, who immediately bombed?
Yeah.
Because he'd been playing behind, say, Clemens.
But they used
to
play in reserve matches years ago. Yep. The number twos don't play
in reserve.
So these are professional footballers that play two games a year.
Yeah.
Well, curiously, not to go back to this, of course, Stoke also going with Sorensen, who played most of the FA Cup instead of Begovic in the final.
But what a save! From Balotelli.
Tremendous save. But going back to Ewood Park, the penalty incident with Robinson coming out on Hernandez. I guess we can clear this up once and for all. It really doesn't, I mean, make much of a difference whether he touched him or not, and I think he did touch him. It had to be a penalty. Am I right, Dicko?
Yes, you're right.
You're right. Yeah, I mean, I've sort of heard people trying to turn it into a debate. I'm still not quite sure why, to be honest.
I can't see the debate. The only debate I can see is how big a spanking Paul Robinson should get for making an error like that at the age of 32.
Well, first of all, he was slow to react.
Yes.
The ball should have been his in the first place, yes. But he was slow to react. And then by going down, he was always going to give the penalty away because Hernandez wouldn't have scored from that from that angle.
No.
You know, let's talk about what happened in the last 10 minutes of this game, because this is something that I'm very used to seeing in Italy when you have a result which suits both teams. And, you know, hey, you know, you guys likely stay up. We win the title. That's great. Nobody wants to concede the goal. So they end up passing it around. It's not something I generally associate with the Premier League. Am I the only... Should I just grow up and say this is reality?
In this situation, it didn't upset either supporters.
Of course not.
But it might have
upset a Blackpool fan, for example.
It probably did, and it might upset the neutral who's watching on the telly for the last minute, because you might as well just turned it off and said, well, we know what the outcome is going to be. But you can understand both teams doing it. You know, Manchester United don't have to push for a goal. Blackburn don't really want to push for a goal, so they certainly
don't
want to
lose. I saw the same thing happen in a Champions League game at Old Trafford. I think Bayern were there, and they just played out time for one all, because that was suited the both clubs in the group. Mm. I think that we've come on a long, long way since 1982, was it?
When Tunisia were
cheated by Germany and Austria.
It was Algeria.
Algeria, I beg your pardon. Were cheated, and then there was a sort of mood of outrage. I think people feel now that use the rules. I certainly felt no sense of outrage at all.
Well, also, that game that you're talking about, they did it from the start of the game. Uh-huh. This game, Manchester United, but they played honestly and competitively for 85 minutes.
You certainly
minutes,
couldn't accuse, I mean, presumably the complaint from the fellow relegation clubs would have been about Blackburn, and nobody could say that Blackburn didn't give a terrific account of themselves over the 90 minutes.
Absolutely.
Dicko, you get the last word on Blackburn. Much of the season, people have sort of, people have been kind of unkind to Blackburn, maybe with good reason, but you know, between Venkies and the guy who looks like a Bollywood star and Big Sam at first, and then Big Sam going, and then the Steve Keen and all this jazz. Hey, what kind of Blackburn should we expect next season, presumably in the Premier League?
I think the reason there was so much sort of scepticism was that, you know, there's been some daft sackings, and the one of Allardyce seemed to win the prize, basically. I mean, and I don't think staying up, you know, sort of gives them any vindication for that. I mean, it was bizarrely handled. The only reason seemed to be because of sort of some kind of agent manoeuvring behind the scenes. All very, very oddly and badly handled. But yeah, I mean, it looks like they're going to stay up, and I think they're taking it seriously, Venkies. I know they're house hunting in the area. They're going to spend. They're going to buy a place. They're going to sort of be around more often. The fascination now is whether they're actually going to throw some proper money at it. But I'm just slightly confused why they went for Blackburn. I mean, because it was buyable, obviously. But I mean, the gates have always been a problem there. I don't see how they're going to create a force there. And you know, they're talking about, you know, we want Champions League, and which is just a complete nonsense. Even European football, if they're doing it for the money, I can't understand the rationale in the slightest.
Well, since it's the end of the year and it's a special season, we actually have a special guest with us, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dave Boyle. Now, I first met Dave a few years ago. He helped us out with our book, The Italian Job. And back then, Dave, you weren't a big shot because you weren't the chief executive of Supporters Direct, but you are now.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, can you tell us what Supporters Direct mission statement is, the main things they do?
Yeah, I mean, we're an organisation, we've been around for about 10 years now, and we work with football fans and increasingly fans of other sports, but mainly football, to get involved in the ownership and management and governance of their club. They do this through supporters trusts. Many people will have heard of them. The biggest one is the Man United Supporters Trust. And we support those individual groups at different clubs. There's about 170 across the UK. We're also doing a bit of work in Europe now. And we also sort of have a policy function where we sort of get all their voices, get all their requests, and sort of channel them through to government, through to the FA, through to the leagues, so we can sort of press for changes which help all of us in the Supporters Trust movement.
And so basically, for those who don't know, the Supporters Trust is basically an organization of supporters where they haven't been successful. I mean, if they can buy shares in a club so they have a voice within the club, they do that. If not, they remain independent. And
they'll look for whatever avenues they can at their club. If the club's got shares like a club like Arsenal, you've got the Arsenal Supporters Trust who've created the fan share scheme to give fans a chance to buy in when shares are £10,000 a pop. At other clubs where there aren't shares available, they'll lobby and campaign and ask for, and it might start off with meetings with the chief executive or the chairman to give them a bit more dialogue, but you try and work all the way up to a seat on the board, because that's where the decisions get made, and it's about putting the voice of fans at the place where it matters most whilst decisions are being made, rather than dealing with the consequences of decisions which have already been taken, which may or may not be once the course is set, it's pretty difficult to turn the ship around.
Can I ask you about Rushden and Diamonds?
Yeah,
because Rushden and Diamonds, when I was there, they were owned by Max Griggs, and then he went bankrupt, and then another chap took them over, and then I think they sold out to the Supporters, or the Supporters took them over.
Max Griggs gave it away to the Supporters Trust, and then they couldn't deal with the fact that...
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Max Griggs had inflated the club so far beyond what it was sustainably able to do. They sold to another guy, Keith Cousins, who I think had been involved at Peterborough, and he suddenly found the same problem. You know, the problem really wasn't the Supporters Trust, it was that Rushden and Diamonds had been paying wages for a club with about three times the gates of Rushden and Diamonds.
But I know it wasn't successful, was it?
No, I mean, and this is the problem we've always found, that where Supporters Trusts have become involved in a big way in the club, where they've had a clean sheet to work from, they've done amazingly well. Exeter City had a horrible inheritance, but thanks to Tony Cascarino drawing them against Man United in 2005, they cleared those debts. And now look at them. They've achieved the best position they've ever achieved of the club. Their gates are at 70% up in 5 years' time without a single big signing. Alternatively, you look at places like York, where they couldn't get past the fact that the previous chairman had sold the ground to himself and then sold it to a house builder, and they had to find the money to pay him back. Chesterfield had, I think, £1 million worth of debts from a guy who, I think he's out of prison now, but he went to prison for what he'd done at the club. Stockport County, they found that the previous owner had sold the ground to a rugby union club, which was, it's always going to be a hampering. And what we find is that supporters often end up as the owner of last resort when the alternative is liquidation, and it's pretty bad the circumstances you get, and you're fighting with one hand behind your back. What we have found, though, if you look at places like AFC Wimbledon, FC United, Chester, yesterday Telford United got promoted to the Conference, where you've got a clean slate, supporter ownership is a really successful way to do
it. But there must be infighting amongst the supporters as well, mustn't it? What they're trying to achieve and where they're trying to go.
You would be surprised. That's the sort of idea, but what you tend to find is that what happens happens when the supporters trust getting control is that you don't get egos which are wanting to make the team successful this season as opposed to the success and existence of the club over the medium and longer term. So people have got a degree of sanity and a bit of grounding in reality, because they can't pay silly money. There's nobody who's writing a cheque for the ambition the club wants to pursue, and as a result they tend to cut their cloth much more sort of economically and prudently. And you know, you get a calming down. I was chatting to a guy, Julian Tagg, who's on the board at Exeter City, and he said, yeah, we get people who moan about the team if we have three defeats, but people aren't calling to sack the manager because they know that sacking the manager costs the club a load of money in severance pay, and then there'll be a new guy and all his people, and the club just doesn't have the luxury of that kind of chopping and changing, and it has to stick with the guy they've got and back him and try and support him accordingly. And I think, you know, you just get a degree of realism which I think football desperately needs. It needs some people to actually say, but let's try and grow organically over time the way clubs used to grow.
But my slight worry is also that then don't the fans want to pick the team eventually?
No, the only people who think fans want to pick the team are basically people who I think, you know, you look at what happened with Ebbsfleet United, and they did a complete disservice to the Supporters Trust movement.
Absolutely.
Because it's never been about picking the team, it's been about picking the board and, crucially, getting people off the board who aren't doing a good job.
I wanted to get on to the select committee. Yep. Because obviously, you know, you were involved with that. Sometimes when politicians take a, you know, we blame politicians for not caring, and then sometimes when they take an interest, they're interfering. What sort of mindset did these people have? Because I think in politicians, I think of that nut job in, what was it, Sheffield or someplace up north, who after Steve McLaren and you know, in England were knocked out, he went on that rant in Parliament about how they didn't care and whatever else. And yeah. I think, yeah. you know, I think a deluded...
Well, the select committee, there are some MPs who are
deluded pinheads.
Who are deluded pinheads, and football being our national sport gives them an opportunity to get column inches, which talking about more pressing and more homespun concerns wouldn't give them. So that guy, you know, you say he's a pinhead, but he also probably got elected last time because of a bit of publicity. So you can do the maths there. In this select committee case, though, the select committee is slightly different from the sort of knockabout world of the House of Commons chamber. It's supposed to examine issues in more detail, and you've got people who have to study the evidence, who have to go on fact-finding missions and speak to the people concerned. Now, these MPs are busy people, so...
And so you volunteer for the select committee?
You get chosen for the select committee on a party basis. So I think there's 11 members of it, and I think there are 6 Conservative members, because they're the governing party, 1 Liberal Democrat and a few Labour MPs as well.
May I also say at this point that the contributions to the committee, I mean, people talk about talking shops and halitosis hall and so on, but the plain fact is that the contributions to that committee of not only yourself, but even more dramatically, Ian Watmore,
yeah, absolutely,
and the former FA chief executive, who gave a magnificent presentation to that, equally David Treisman,
yeah,
who has actually been beckoned out of the closet and told the truth,
yeah,
about and given us a much greater insight into the level of corruption at the highest councils of FIFA. So, I mean, a lot of knowledge, light has been shed by this hearing. And it's not only given it would be worthwhile alone, if only to cement the relationship between the parliamentary body, the cross-party parliamentary body, and supporters directly. Yeah. For example, yeah, it'd be worth it, but it's also provided some terrific enlightenment.
And it's got stuff. What's quite interesting is that you speak to a lot of journalists, and there isn't a lot of sort of new stuff being said, but it's being said dramatically,
yes,
in front of a committee of MPs, and it can't be ignored.
Yes.
A lot of the stuff Ian Watmore said was absolutely common knowledge to anybody who
but he
covered
knew
the beat.
It wouldn't be worthwhile going to a newspaper with it, because nobody would listen.
Absolutely, and it starts to and it just becomes part of the common sort of background of football, that it's not run very well and there's tensions between all the various governing bodies. Having it said in front of a load of MPs on the record, it's done a great service. Yes. People like myself.
I think it has, although I think we need we need to be cautious about how much clout they're going to, you know, they'll follow.
I think we are all cautious about that. Yeah. But, it's better than nothing.
I mean, I'm not saying it isn't, but it just need, you know. I mean, basically, you know, and I was there for Watmore, and it was superb, and he he laid out a sort of, you know, if you were starting from scratch, how these relationships in the FA and the Premier League should you know, you would build it if you could, you know, start from the bottom. But the fact is, we can't. And the sports minister can talk a big brave game, but I'm not sure he's got the cojones to take on the Premier League. So,
Now I wanted to get on. Want to ask something else here about the select committee, which is, so we have all these revelations, and now the next step is, you know, what happens next, what goes forward. I mean, one thing that struck me was, without getting too bogged down in the specific, but obviously Treisman makes these accusations, and I look at them and I say, none of this is in any way, can in any way be prosecuted or investigated, possibly the Warner stuff. But at the same time, the England 2018 bid committee had set aside $500 million for global development. So if Warner is asking for some of that money, well, it's because it's there. And I think, you know, you can't go out and say he's asking for a bribe, or at least not believably in a court of law. And it seems to me also Treisman's doing this in Parliament, where he knows he can't be sued. So, does anything come of this?
I think I think there's two issues in terms of what practically gets recommended by the select committee and the sort of more the more public sort of the way it spins out. I think, you know, nobody's going to think that if you can't corroborate what Treisman says, that means they're not true, because it's like that American concept of truthiness.
Right.
They scream truthiness. Mm-hmm. That the people who, you know, let's put it bluntly, you lock 24 people in a room and hold them completely unaccountable for a decision which will lead to billions of pounds going in one direction or another. And, you know, the idea that, you know, if there's only 8 people who are corrupt, then, you know, why are the other 16 not doing it? Because it's all set up to be one of the most corrupt processes since the medieval church chose its popes. But the in terms of the select committee,
wait,
here,
you mean it wasn't God choosing the popes?
He was speaking through them, and God sometimes needed a favour to be asked to sort of prove the faith.
God doesn't come free.
Absolutely. It costs a lot of money to get a God that good. But the select committee has been asked to do this by the government, and I think the government have got a manifesto commitment which they were elected upon, and to some degree they've said, well how can we do it? Because in the course of doing our evidence to the select committee, I just googled the Chester report from 1968, which very few people bother to go back to, but it basically says English football approached the government in 67 and said, we're broke, we're dealing with the maximum wage, which has just gone, and we're now struggling with decades worth of infrastructure developments we've not done, which was why in 66 half the grounds were designed by Archibald Leach and they'd not been changed since. So the government said, well, there's a problem with football clubs' cost control, they can't control their spending, and there's a disconnect between their fans and the clubs, and there needs to be some supporter representation on the board. Dennis Howell, Minister for Sport, everyone says one of the very best ones we've had in this country, says in Parliament, I will absolutely guarantee that this will happen. Nothing happens. And we went through all the reports in the last 40 years, and it's about a foot high of reports saying football's governance is challenged, needs to be changed, something has to be done, and nothing ever gets done. So I think the challenge this time is, what are you going to do different, Minister of Sport, than your 14 predecessors who've tried to crack this very nut and have failed? The interesting idea which has been talked about is of a sports bill in Parliament. One of the problems you have in the UK, which you don't have in several other European countries, is that there is absolutely no interface between the minister and sport. He has no power. Putting him in the cabinet doesn't change the fact that all he can do is make speeches. If you're a small sport which needs your money from government, then you've got a lever. You can get British Luge over the coals, and you can demand them make changes. But when you're a sport which is independently wealthy, government have very little power, and that's something which other European countries have found ways to tackle. The Spanish, you know, it's got its flaws, but you've got the highest sports council, so it's an arm's length agency which can bring the FA in, and it can compel changes in the national association. Now you might wonder why they've not made changes over, say, their policy towards the racism, which seems to be somewhat endemic in the Spanish game, but the power exists.
Jump in there, but you have to be careful about that, because there's a FIFA statute that clearly says if you allow government interference in the running of your national FA, you will be suspended from FIFA.
I think there are two issues with that one. One, in the current climate, I think a lot of people would say, so what?
Yes,
and you know, if FIFA are not going to reform themselves and prevent us from reforming our own FA, then that's a degree of intolerableness, right, which we can't. But also, what do we mean by interference? FIFA are very upset when individuals at the very top of the National Association get removed on government diktat. They seem to be less concerned about dictators putting their brother-in-law in that position. But let's skip that one. Yeah. If you want to say simply, though, that if the government wants to give support to the national governing body of a sport, public funds, infrastructure, security, policing for major tournaments, for example, the national governing body has to prove it's well-governed, it has proper stakeholder engagement, and it's not run as essentially a Victorian boys' club.
When into the year 2000, the government provided £125 million of public money towards the purchase of the site on which a commercial organisation would build a commercial, what they imagined was a commercially viable new stadium. There was no howls from FIFA that this was government interference in the sport.
He's talking about Wembley.
They just took the money.
And I think as a taxpayer, I think it's only right that you if you get something from the taxpayer, you get something comes back the other way.
We have to wrap it here, but Dave, can you tell us, well, basically reiterate the main points that fans should know about, and also tell us if people do want to get involved with Supporters Direct, how they can do that.
We've just published two reports which look at what the Select Committee could do and what government could do, and they're available on our website, which is www.supporters-direct.coop. That's COOP. The next stage is that the committee will probably make its report in the next 2-3 weeks, and then government will respond. And at that point, there'll be a debate in the House of Commons again. This started because of a debate by Steve Rotherham, the MP for Liverpool Walton, about what was happening at Liverpool last September, and there were about 50-60 MPs turned up. We'd hope a similar attendance, and people who feel strongly can actually lobby their MPs and say, if this Select Committee report isn't good enough, say why. If it's a great report which recommends really good changes, which we'd really want to see government getting behind, then we need to be saying that as well. But the next stage is to see what this report says. As people have said, the evidence has been pretty strong in the committee, and I think, unlike previous inquiries, this time it's not spent 6 weeks deciding is there a problem with governance in England. It's a case of what are the problems, and now it's on to what are the solutions. It's not easy, but I think the tide's moving in the right direction. But having done this for 10 years, you learn to temper your optimism with the grim reality of the way in which things move.
Grim realities. Dave Boyle, thanks so much. All right, time now for some quick hits. Mm-hmm. Two goals down at home, second lowest attendance in the Premier League, dead last. Paddy, how did Roberto Martinez engineer Wigan's incredible comeback? And can they hope in a miracle next weekend?
I do hope so. The answer to the question, though, is good management. Martinez is a proper manager who I think is going to go on and have further success, either with Wigan or perhaps with a bigger club. And I think there's a unity about the club there that if they do go up will be the main reason.
That defeat, of course, also cost West Ham their place in the Premier League, and it cost Avram Grant his job. Dicko, any reason why Gold, Sullivan and Brady felt the need to sack him right then and there beyond wanting to humiliate the guy? And are they really the unholy trinity?
Well, I suspect, they sacked him because they're feeling like idiots for not sacking him before, and then feeling doubly like idiots for appointing him in the first place. I mean, I couldn't. He's a nice guy, Avram. I've had the pleasure of dinner with him. Nice bloke. But I can't for the life of me see why he was appointed. West Ham's still got a cachet. He could have appointed a far better manager. He's done a lousy job. Deserves the sack. But humiliating him in the process, not necessary.
And Karen Brady still in a job. Arsenal go down again, 2-1 at home to Aston Villa as Darren Bent scores two. Stuart, we've asked you where it all went wrong before so many times that I'm not going to ask you about that. But I want to ask you, are Arsenal going to hang on to third place? And should Arsene Wenger go the way of Avram Grant?
First question, I think they won't get third place. I think Arsenal will lose at Fulham next week because Fulham seem to be in good form. Should Arsene Wenger go the same way as Avram Grant? Many supporters feel he should. I think he's got to do a lot of work in the summer, and he's got to take a good, hard, long look at himself. Is he going to be better defence? Is he going to organise that back four? Is he going to get the balance right between attacking football and defensive football? And if he doesn't get that right, there's only one place that he's going to be going, and that's out the door.
Silence, Dan. Are you listening? Blackpool and Bolton put on a dramatic 7-goal thriller to keep Ian Holloway's hopes of staying up alive, although he'll have his work cut out for him at Old Trafford next week. Paddy, was this actually a great game or a game filled with plenty of mistakes, or both?
It was both, just like the game at Wigan. Weren't they two sensational matches. And I've been saying this all along, that good teams are going to be relegated this season. There shouldn't be a shame in relegation when you're Blackpool if they do go down. I rather feel that they may. I feel that Old Trafford may be their last visit to the Premier League for a while. But my word, what they have, for me, they've been one of the teams of the season. But yeah, it's great entertainment.
Kenny Dalglish signs a 3-year deal, keeping him at Anfield, but the start isn't particularly auspicious. A 2-0 home defeat against Spurs. Dicko, given that this is a rare week with no Liverpool fans in the studio, you get to answer this one. Please tell me that Liverpool did the right thing in keeping King Kenny around, and this is just a nasty, nasty blip.
They did do the right thing in keeping him around. I mean, I was a sceptic about Kenny's return. He's proved me wrong, although I will say thus far, I mean, no one can dispute what he's done, uniting the club, and he's done it. He could only have done this at Liverpool. I'm not sure he would have been successful anywhere else. It's one of those bizarre sort of matters of chemistry in football that sort of somehow defy all the sort of theories that you can ever throw out there. It's been great to see. I do hope it continues, but I'll judge any rain on more than 6 months.
Matt Dickinson getting all metaphysical there. Wolves pull one out again, getting the better of strikerless Sunderland with a win that will go a long way towards keeping them up. Stuart, tell me some good things that Mick McCarthy has done at Molineux.
He seems to have got spirit right at the right time. I'm not a great fan of Mick McCarthy and his style of management. I don't think he's a coach. I watch his teams play. They don't inspire me. But in the recent weeks, they've played with an enthusiasm. They look as though they're going to score goals. The front players have done well and they've shown lots of energy. That's about as much as I can say about Mick McCarthy.
Anyway, Gab, time for you to answer one, because we've got the Europa League final coming up. With so much talk about the Champions League final, we've forgotten there's an absolutely fascinating Europa League in Dublin final in Dublin between two Portuguese clubs, one of them managed by the intriguing André Villas-Boas. Explain all, please.
Yeah, of course, André Villas-Boas is he was originally Mourinho's assistant. He's going to be the big story everywhere he goes this summer, although I understand he's staying at Porto. Definitely one to look out for. But also Porto, some very good players, a strike force of Hulk and Radamel Falcao, scoring more than 70 goals between them this season. But let's not forget Braga as well. You know, we all talk about sort of stability in a settled lineup. Braga, absolutely incredible. They only have two players who've played more than 75% of their minutes this season. Basically, they're constantly rotating in and out. Smart manager in Domingos Paciência, but basically a very well-run club. Ultimate underdogs in this final, and I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks for joining us. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your gossip, your analysis. If you're not a subscriber and you don't want to commit for a whole month, remember, you can get a day pass. It's only £1. And also, you can enjoy all our web chats. Mine's on Mondays, Paddy's is on
Tuesdays.
And of course, Ollie Kay and Graham Spears do one as well. And if all else fails, you can always follow us on Twitter. Till next week, goodbye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.